Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the backyard. This is Margaret Marshall, your host, and I'd like to welcome you to the Labrish. We gather here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. So I want to welcome all the callers on the board. I want to welcome the visitors who may come by later once we have been archived, and the ones that are calling in. So welcome, welcome, welcome. My, how the time is flying. Imagine we're starting the last month of the first quarter of the year. It's almost 3 months since it's been Christmas, and before you know it, the year will be gone. So I think as we get older, things just seem to speed up, because I just cannot even believe that it's March already. So it will soon be springtime, and hopefully all the places that are experiencing bad weather, the spring will break forth. And we will all be enjoying some pollen in my part of the world. There's a lot of pollen, but we welcome the spring with open arms. So for my listeners who are on the list, my mailing list, you know that for the past couple of weeks, we have been really getting deep into the roots of our culture because of the mix in our culture, actually. Because we're finding out the different ethnic groups that came to Jamaica at the various times they came and why they came. I've just been really, really intrigued with the wonderful information that has been put out on the internet. And if you go to Pieces of the Past, that's published by the Jamaican Gleaner, you will see that Dr. Rebecca Tortello has done a wonderful job at researching and putting together Pieces of the Past. And we are now doing Jamaica and the different groups that came at different periods and how it all blends so well for the Jamaica we know who are growing up there now and who grew up in my period, which would be a long time ago. So we won't even talk about that. And for the people who may be visiting our show for the first time, I'd just like to tell you that we have a very relaxed platform. This is not a political forum or, you know, we're not on any special agenda here. So we do as I said in the beginning, we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve. And I am not a professional host. I am just sort of experiencing or living a passion that I have for my culture and my country. So I do a little research, and I encourage listeners on the board to raise their hands by hitting 1 on your telephone, because you can always join the conversation. Although the information that I've been reading for the past couple of weeks is online, anyone can go to it, but usually I don't read it as if I'm giving a lecture, hopefully. I put in my 2 cents, I call it my sidebar, and I invite you, if you feel like just sharing with us and the rest of the world, to just participate and put in your 2 cents. So so feel free. The minute I see a hand on the board, I will, at the convenient time, just let you in so we can hear what you have to say. So just relax, be comfortable. When we get together on Wednesdays, we have a virtual trip to Jamaica. It's really inexpensive. You just have to close your eyes, and if you've been there, if you've grown up there or visited there, you know how just being there, seeing the beauty of the island, can just put you in a very restful mood. So this is your chilling time, your me time, as the young folks say. So get in your favorite chair. You can perhaps put your phone on speaker, or if you're listening online, just minimize the page and just relax and just pretend you're hearing the waves or feeling the trade winds drift gently across your face. So without any further ado, I'd just like to share with you, if you did not get in on the last couple of shows, I learned so much, because we know that I started off with when the Chinese came, which the first group came in 1854. And as I read the story, I realized that they were the first on the island to offer credit to the other occupants of the island that did not, you know, had to wait to payday or whenever they had the money, because they would buy the things they sold in large portions, because they were from China or Hong Kong or wherever they came from at the time, and they could make it in smaller packages and sell it to the people who did not have a lot of money and could not buy it in bulk. So I just consider them as the first to expend in credit. That's my sidebar. And then the Indians came, and they brought, both of these groups came as indentured servants at the time when they came. And they brought a very interesting ceremonial. I suppose it had to do with their religious, how they expressed their spirituality. They brought their special plant. And for the American people that might not know it, it's called ganja in Jamaica. So according to the documentation, the Indians are the ones who brought it there, as well as rice. And they were the first to plant rice on the island. And so we're just learning so much from the details in these articles. And I hope that my listeners are finding it as interesting and fun as I'm finding it. Because, you know, even though some of it is really so harsh and hard, we just have to look at the other side of it and see all the positive things that came out of the whole mix. So now I'm going to really speak about the largest group to come, and perhaps under the worst circumstances, and that is the Africans. And Dr. Tortella starts her article by saying up until the early 1690s, Jamaica's population was relatively equally mixed between white and black, and she's taken that from somebody else's research. The first Africans to arrive came in 1513 from the Iberian Peninsula after having been taken from West Africa by the Spanish and Portuguese. They were servants, cowboys, herders of cattle, pigs, and horses, as well as hunters. When the English captured Jamaica in 1655, many of them fought with the Spanish, who gave them their freedom, and they then fled to the mountains, resisting the British for many years to maintain their freedom, becoming known as the Maroons. And those of us who grew up in Jamaica in the 30s and 40s know a little about the Maroons. I really did not know a lot about them, but I know about them in Akopong, I forgot the name, how it's pronounced anyway, where they lived. And I would like, if anyone on the board knows, if they are still exempt from the rules and regulations of the rest of the country and they are self-governing. I don't know, this article doesn't say that, and I can't seem to find any other information about them. So it would be nice to fill that in. Okay, back to the article. So let me know if anyone has any information on that. I just think it would be very interesting to know how many of the original Maroons are still living there in the cockpit country. I know that's where it is. And if they're still self-governed, or how much are they interacting or intermingling with the rest of the people who live in that area. So please help me out here if you would. Now back to the article. By 1700, Jamaica was awash with sugar plantations, and Jamaica's population was comprised of 7,000 English to 40,000 slaves. The sugar industry grew quickly in Jamaica. In 1672, there were 70 plantations producing 772 tons of sugar per annum, growing in the 1770s to over 680 plantations. By 1800, it was 21,000 English to 300,000 slaves, which increased to some 5,000 slaves by the 18th century. In 1820, there were 5,349 properties in Jamaica, of which 1,189 contained over 100 slaves. And she has the source on the documents of where that information came from. Now, each estate was its own small world, complete with an entire labor force of field workers and skilled artists, a hospital, water supply, cattle, mules, and horses, as well as its own fuel source. Each plantation fueled the wheels of British merchandising. Sugar, molasses, and rum were exported to England for sale, and ships were financed to return to Africa and collect more slaves in exchange for trinkets and transport them to the West Indies as a labor force. This became known as the triangular trade. Money was not left in England's colonies. The financing came from Mother England, and to Mother England, the profits returned. So that's the end of the first paragraph. So we can see there what was happening in that period. Dr. Tortorella really gives a lot of information about what life was like for, as I read on, you'll find that out. And a little more details about, you know, the individual, how the plantations were run, and as you heard there, they were like a world, world within a small world, a small world within the island. Each plantation was its own world. I suppose they didn't even overlap unless for special things. But if you lived and worked there, that was it. So let me see a hand if we have anything on the Maroon story. Back to the article. To a large extent, Jamaica customs and culture were fashioned by sugar. According to John Hearn, who wrote something in 1965, for 200 years, sugar was the only reason behind Jamaica's existence as a center for human habitation, as quoted in another book. Now, for centuries, sugar was Jamaica's most important crop. Jamaica was once considered the jewel in Britain's crown. In 1805, the island's peak of sugar production, it produced 101,600 tons of sugar. It was the world's leading industrial sugar producer. The cultivation of sugar was intricately intertwined with the system of slavery. This connection has set the course of the nation's demographics since the 18th century, when slaves vastly outnumbered any other population group. The descendants of these slaves comprised the majority of Jamaica's population. They have influenced every sphere of Jamaican life, and their contributions are immeasurable. Now she goes to the Atlantic slave trade. The Atlantic slave trade began in the 15th century when the Portuguese took hold of land near Gibraltar and soon encountered African devout Catholics. They quickly took these heathens prisoners, and by mid-century, the first public sale of these prisoners was held. By 1455, Portugal was importing close to 800 African slaves a year, bartering for them peacefully instead of capturing them through warfare. I just want to take a little sidebar here. So according to this document, the Portuguese first took them as prisoners of war. That's what they were first taken from. That's how they were first taken. And then it became a trade to, I suppose, other Africans to exchange them for, you know, trinkets and things before they start, I suppose, getting them in masses. I find that very interesting. Anyway, let me go back here. So they were bartering. All right, sugar cultivation began on the island, and as the demand for sugar grew, so did the demand for slaves to work the fields of the sugarcane. By the 16th century, other countries wanted a piece of this action, and the competition for the sugar and slave trade began. So it's like everything else, it started off small, and since it was profitable and successful, it increased, and other people wanted to get in on what was going on. And as I always try to, think about how, as human beings, so much has changed in our world, but how some of our behaviors really simulate things that were happening centuries ago. So I'm sure we can relate to a lot of things, even right now all over the world. I mean, one man trying to impose their style or their religion or something on a whole group of people, or people being, I would say, dehumanized for one purpose or the other, or discriminated against because of their religion, or it's just wild how we have not really changed in so many ways. Anyway, let me go back to the article. And I'm anxious for someone on the board to join the library, so feel free, please, because, you know, I'll go off on sidebars all night. But let me go back to the... And I want to tell you that I really enjoy, and I'm always reading these articles for the first time. So if I'm babbling sometimes, just bear with me. Remember, I'm a senior citizen. I don't even see very well. But I'm doing the best I can. But I hope you love history as much as I do. And if you want the pristine version of these stories, please go to Pieces of the Past, which can be found, it's printed on the, just going into Google and put in Pieces of the Past Jamaica, and you will come to these marvelous articles that were put together by Dr. Rebecca Tortello. And I want to let her know, if she ever listens to our show, how much we appreciate her work. So let me get back here so we can get through this. Between 1500 and 1800, some 11 million Africans were moved as a result of all this raiding. They were captured by war as retribution for crimes committed, or by abduction, and marched to the coast in coffees, C-O-F-F-I-E-S, with their necks yoked to each other. They were placed in trading posts on forts to await the horrifying 6 to 12 weeks middle passage voyage between Africa and the Americas, during which they were chained together, kept in the ship's hold in the thousands, between Africa and the Americas, during which they were chained together. So those who survived were fattened up and oiled to look healthy prior to being auctioned in public squares to the highest bidder. Now, Jamaican slaves tended to come from from West Africa, the Mandingo and Yoruba. Apparently, those are the tribes. Field slaves fetched £25 to £75, while skilled slaves, such as carpenters, fetched prices as high as £300. And she has the quote from where she got that information there, too. On reaching the plantation, they underwent a seasoning process in which they were placed with an experienced slave who taught them the ways of the estate. Now I want to take another little sidebar. Because, you know, when I came to this country in 1959, I realized that there was a lot of difference between the culture I was born and raised in as a Jamaican and the American society, you know, the Black Americans. There was a lot of difference in my culture and their culture. And as I read this about the new slaves being put with the older slaves to be seasoned, I can figure that in order to do that, they must have spoken the same language. And since they were mostly coming from the same place, the same part of West Africa, apparently they understood each other, so there was more bonding. I'm just making this up, but I can imagine that there was possibly more bonding between them, because even though they might not have known each other, one was new, one was young, old on the estate, but they apparently really communicated. So there was a bonding being formed early when I don't think that was going on the plantations here. I think a lot from what I read or have been reading about the history here, a lot of the slaves on the plantation did not speak the same language, even though they were from Africa. But as we know, it's such a huge continent that people, even in Jamaica, our patois is different from one part of the island to another part of the island, even now. So I can imagine that way back then, when people were being moved around, especially from Africa, they didn't understand each other at all. So I can see how even that could make a difference in relationships and how people view each other and perhaps trust each other and just communicate. So if anyone in on the board would like to weigh in, please do, because I am just getting so much, so inspired as I read this in just better understanding of human behavior. But let me go back to the article before I get too caught up again. Although the initial slave trade was from the Portuguese and the Dutch between 1750 and 1807, the year in which the British Empire abolished the slave trade, Britain dominated the buying and selling of slaves to the Americas. Did I read that already? No, I didn't. So let me go back here. Shipbuilding flourished and manufacturing expanded. The process of industrialization in England from the second quarter of the 18th century as to an important extent a response to colonial demands for rails, axes, buckets, coaches, clocks, and saddles, and a thousand of other things, as quoted in Sherlock and Bennett, which is another publication that she writes, that she took this research from. So we're getting a little history about what was going on in as England developed industrially. Now, we're back to sugar estates. The typical sugar estate was 900 acres. This included a great house where the owner or overseer and the domestic slaves lived, and nearby accommodations for the bookkeeper, distiller, mason, carpenter, blacksmith, copper, and wheelwright. I don't know what a wheelwright is, but apparently it's a craftsman who does something. With the exception of the bookkeeper, by the middle of the 18th century, skilled black slaves had replaced white indentured servants in these posts. The field slave quarters were usually about a half a mile away, closer to the industrial sugar mill. Distillers and the boiling and curing houses, as well as the blacksmith and the carpenter's shed and trash houses. In addition, there was a poultry pen and a cattle yard, along with a Negro hospital. Some estates, if large enough, had accommodation for an estate doctor. Now, that seemed to tell me that in Jamaica, the plantations actually had places, special places, for the slaves to do their own thing. I mean, they had their own hospitals, they were in special huts. Quite interesting. All right, let me go to the second page here. And again, you're listening to Backyard Labrish. We're here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock, where we celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And tonight, as we did in the past 3 weeks, we're really getting into the depth of our cultural mix and how we became one people, just Jamaicans. So let me go back. Estates and estate gardens, and the slaves had their own kitchen gardens. So the estates had gardens, and the slaves had their own kitchen gardens, as well as a polnick, P-O-L-N-I-C-K. What is that? A provision ground. Oh, that's what it is. A provision ground found in the hills, which were required by law from as early as 1678. So apparently, they passed a law that they had to have their own gardens. Huh. During slavery, however, slaves kept pigs and poultry and grew mangoes, plantains, ackee, okra, yam, and other ground provisions. The cultivation of these lands took on greater proportions as plantations were abandoned when the island faced increasing competition from Brazil, Cuba, and beet sugar, a loss in labor and emancipation in the 1830s, as well as the loss of protective trade duties after the passage of the 1846 Sugar Equalization Act of England. So we're now hearing that not only did they have their own kitchens and their own gardens, they also grew their own food. And apparently then it was required by law. Huh. They had their own, they grew all the things we know so well, mangoes, plantains, ackee, wow, and had their own pigs and poultry. That is, was a big difference from what was happening here in this country. I am really, really getting a good education now, and I hope our listeners will really feel that way too. So let me go back here. The workforce on each plantation was divided into gangs, determined by age and fitness. On average, most estates had three main field gangs. The first was comprised of the oldest and the most able men and women. The second was comprised of those no longer able to serve in the first. And the third, of older slaves and older children. Some estates had four gangs, depending on the number of children living on the estate. Children started working as young as three or four years old. Oh my gosh. Jamaican slaves came mainly from West Africa. Their customs survived based on memory and myths. They encompassed the life cycle, i.e. a newborn was not regarded as being of this world until 9 days had passed, and burials often involved lipidation at the graveside, and the belief that the dead body's spirit would not be at rest for some 40 days. So that old-time habit of the mothers in my day not bringing the babies out for 9 days came way back from those times. I didn't even realize that. I remember when I was growing up, when a woman had a baby, the baby didn't come out of the house until it was 9 days old. So now I know where all of that is coming from. I don't know if I remember about the 40 days after a person is dead thing, but apparently that is some of the whether belief or myth, memory or myth that came out of Africa. But I just want to put something in here that I sort of calculated. The Spanish were the first ones to have people from West Africa, and they were the ones that were captured by the Portuguese and worked as cowboys and herders and all of that. They were not even spoken of as slaves. I suppose they were considered servants. So it was 145 years before the British took over from the Spanish. And that's when the real slave trade started. The first set of Africans came to the island brought by the Spanish in 1513. And the British started bringing in their set in 1655. That meant that there were Africans on the island before the real onslaught of slavery for 142 years. And I don't know if anybody has found that interesting, but that is a couple of lifetimes, because in those days people didn't live to be as old as we are living now. So that was quite something. All right, let me go back to the article. Boy, I'm getting a real, real great educational lesson from these articles. Now, let's talk about some of the customs that they brought. They recreated African musical instruments from materials found in Jamaica, like bamboo and different things, the conch shells, and they featured improvisations in songs and dance. All of these customs and many more, such as the Christmas street parade of Jankuno, were misunderstood and undervalued by Europeans, with the exception of the political use of drumming to send coded messages from plantation to plantation. Drumming of any kind was therefore often banned. Jamaican music today has emerged from the traditional musical forms of work songs sung by slaves, the ceremonial music used in religious services, and the social and recreational music played on holidays and during leisure time. And this is another quote from a publication here on her paper. So Dr. Tortella is gathering some of this information from different sources. Now, let me go back. The cramped housing space provided to the slaves, which limited their dwellings, often made of wattle and daub, to one window and one door, meant that very little other than sleeping took place indoors. Life for them, as in Africa, was lived communally outside. And now we know why we love to be outside so much and gather together and always playing music and dancing. Wow, it's in our genes. Similarly, language, as in Africa, is considered powerful, particularly naming. Given an example of a woman whose child falls ill, when after naming, it gives the name of the book, Brathwaite, 1971. And then what she means is that he gives an example of a woman whose child falls ill and wants her name to be changed, believing that this would allow her to be cured. So it was one of the customs or the beliefs in Africa where this particular woman came from. Language is certainly an area where African retention is strongest. Jamaicans today move between patois as creolized English and standard English. Jamaican patois was born from the intermixing of African slaves, the English, the Irish, the Welsh, the Scottish sailors, slaves, servants, soldiers, and merchants. The African slaves spoke many dialects, and given the need for a common tongue, Jamaican Patois was born. It has been in use since the end of the 17th century by Jamaicans of all ethnicities and has been added to by the Jews, Chinese, Indians, Lebanese, Germans, and French Creole, who also settled on the island. Some words also indicate Spanish and Taino presence in Jamaican history. So we're even our patois come from is a mixture of all the different cultures in the pot. Many of these traditions survive to this day, testament to the strength of West African culture, despite the process of creolization, which means the intermingling of people adjusting to a new environment. That's what that is in parentheses. Now, I just want to invite callers on the board to weigh in if you would like to by hitting 1 on your telephone. That will indicate to me that you'd like to join the Labrish. I'd be glad to open up the mic so the world can hear your voice. So please feel free to do so if you would like. Let me go back here to the article. Famous Jamaicans of African descent. There are too many notable Jamaicans of African descent to name. Here is a small sample. George William Gordon, who is a national hero. George Stebell, the island's first black millionaire who built Devon House. Sir Alexander Bustamante, the island's first prime minister. Norman Manley, the island's first premier. Marcus Garvey, black nationalist and national hero. And more contemporarily, Marlene Otte, Jamaica's track and field star. P.T. Lakey, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, creator of the Jamaica Red Breed of Cattle. Cecil Ball, world-renowned potter. And Bob Marley, worldwide musical superstar. And the Honorable Louise Bennett Coverley, who is our cultural icon. Their impact and that of many other races whose contributions to Jamaican life is in all aspects cultural, artistic, political, economic, scientific, was born out of a brutal system forged through an integration of people and place and emerged as a triumph of the human spirit. It is largely thanks to Jamaicans with connections to Africa that Jamaica is what it is today, an intense land, a place of extremes that is rarely boring or predictable, an island that is little but Talawa. And that is how Dr. Tortella ends the article. So I just found it, like many of the others, so enlightening. I consider this the enlightening part of our objective or our motto or our, you know, what this show is really all about. Because so many of us that have left the island for one reason or another, or at one time or another, that may not be able to go back there to retire, but we still just have so much passion and love for the place. At least I know that is my purpose for doing this broadcast, because my children were born here, my grandchildren. I have three grandsons, and they're all born here. And I don't know that they will know much about me and my culture if I don't leave something. So this is more or less my contribution, and I'm hoping that more people will join me in sharing their views and perhaps a little bit about how they grew up when they grew up there. But I find it interesting because, as you know, the historians are going back and piecing together and gathering information from different sources. And as I read that and sort of, you know, really mull it around in my mind, I see how important it is for us to leave our own history and leave something written in our own words or spoken in our own words about how we grew up. Because right now we feel that the younger generation, many of us, not me anymore, but would feel that perhaps the younger generation are just not interested in what happened in our times. But if we look around us, we see that things are changing so fast. I mean, all over the world, just all over the world. I am sure that the older people in the countries now that is in turmoil has seen such a shift, even before all of the unrest started, in perhaps the way things are compared to the way they were when they were growing up. Because I have friends from different parts of the world, and they would go back to visit and talk about the changes that they see as they go back. Same thing would happen to us if we go to the neighborhood we were raised when we were growing up. It would be totally different. And so the people living there now are doing things totally different. So if we don't leave some history about, you know, how our customs, what we were accustomed to do, what was important to us, it might be hard for someone else to write about it, or it's always better, especially within your family, to leave your own story. So I just would like to encourage the seniors that love history and want to leave a piece of themselves or some information about their families to do so, and not to be afraid of the modern technology, because, you know, cyberspace is wonderful. It's just how you use it. So there are different mediums that you can really engage to really leave your mark. But Blog Talk Radio on Backyard Labrish is one of them. So if you do have a story, or you know someone with a story that and they would like to share it, do just let me know, and I'd be more than happy to have them be a guest on our show so they can tell us something that they want the rest of the world to know about the way they grew up or what they did or what they're doing that might help us celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the wonderful, rich, diverse culture of Jamaica. So with that said, I see a hand, and I want to welcome this caller. So please bear with me while I do so. Oh, dear, I'm having a little problem with my... Hello, the mic is open. This is Margaret. Welcome to the Backyard Labrish. Who do I have?
Lay from the Bronx.
Ooh, good evening, Miss A from the Bronx. How are you today?
Pretty good, thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome. Well, thank you for being on. You're one of my loyal listeners. So what do you have to share with us this evening?
Well, you were wondering at some point whether the Maroons still existed and if they were guided by the treaty that they had signed way back when, 1739. And a friend of mine used to, at that point, this fellow he had various hobbies. At this particular time, he was a very good aerial photographer,
mm-hmm.
black and white. And from time to time, he used to go up to cockpit country until he had a rapport with the guide. Now, you can't just waltz and hike up there. You have to make arrangements, and they send you a guide, and they lead you into the area. I mean, almost as if they were still hiding from the British. No, I mean, you know, it's strange to say that, but don't forget that's how it all started with.
With
some of these.
How it came out. So,
yeah.
But I'm wondering, you know, when you've never seen a place, you wonder, you know, how do they prevent other people from getting in there? Is it, well, I wouldn't ask if it's gate, because, you know.
Well, if they prevented the so-called invaders from getting up there in the old times, they could, because it's so hilly and mountainous, and, you know, you have caves, and they're in the advantageous position in that,
uh-huh.
even if you're coming in with your army, where are you going to go? You don't know your way.
Right. It would be interesting. So he has pictures?
Oh, yes. He, whenever he went up there, I mean, after several trips, he had like a carte blanche to do reasonably whatever he wanted to do. So he would take pictures of mainly of the area, not of the people themselves.
And do you know if any of that is published?
I doubt it.
Oh, he was just taking it for his own personal...
Yes. This was whenever he had a vacation, once or twice a year, he would go up. And he invited me, but look, I wasn't the hiking type, so, you know, I didn't take him up on it, but I could have done.
It would be so interesting for the rest of the world, at least for me, to see some of that, because I can't even imagine, as small as Jamaica is, a group of people living in an area where nobody knows. Well, I didn't. I don't know how many people know what it looks like, what goes on there, you know, just from a curiosity point of view. I think seeing some pictures would be great.
Yeah, well, but their culture, so to speak, was very private in the first place, because they didn't want everybody to be in on where they were on their movements.
So
but,
do you know if it's the same thing now?
Yes.
Really?
Mainly nowadays, a handful of people are left there. So it's more or less a sort of a, I wouldn't say tourist, because a lot of tourists wouldn't go up in that area in the first place necessarily, but for locals, Jamaicans who were interested, they charge them, I don't know if they charge them, but they had to pay a stipend to get in there, you know.
Right, and to guide them up there.
Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
So, but people, of course, by this time, they must be pretty well died out as a group.
Wow.
But because they were isolated from then until the present time.
Right.
So, but I don't have a feel for... I can't give you numbers of our groups of people or whatever it would take to identify them as a a viable group, you know.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because I would think that having, you know, some accurate documentation on them is such a big thing and so important to the history of Jamaicans and the history of their background. You know what I mean? I think that is big. And to just have it sort of not known is a big loss, I think.
Well, if you think of it, just by parallel, the Indians in this country on their reservation, you don't just walk in. You know?
I know, but I still believe that there's a lot more of them. I don't think it is as minute, the amount, you know what I mean? So what happened when the last one died? We'll never know what happened,
right.
What was the culture. And I think that, oh, Lord, but, you know,
well,
I think history is such a precious thing to preserve.
Well, you know, I haven't spoken to my friend for a long time.
Do they live in Jamaica?
Oh, yes. You know,
oh, really?
The next time I visit there, I'm going to ask him
Well,
some
please do.
About
I would love to have him as a guest on the radio show, because then I'm sure that he could perhaps tell of his experience. And I'd like to throw this out to anyone that may be listening or that may come by later, that if they've ever had any contact or, you know, with a true Maroon who was born and raised in the compound and have any information. Because I am trying to figure out whether they have their own schooling, whether they speak a different language. You know, it's just, we just don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, they probably assimilated into Jamaican culture by this time, and they probably speak like you and me, so...
Right.
You know, if we spoke patois, that's what they spoke. Maybe a little different dialect. But,
right, right. But just knowing how their elders, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure the young ones are, like you say, like everybody else. But knowing how they were like people in our age group, I am wondering to myself, did they have a hospital within where they live, or did they?
No, I would doubt that, because these are people that if they were sick, they would use cactus and and boil the cactus, and yeah, they're all home style remedies that the Indians, because don't forget they merged with the naturalized Tainas,
mm-hmm.
Native Tainas, the kind of American Indians, are the Arawaks. And I tell you, I was in Guyana last year and I met some Tainas.
Really?
Yeah, and they have their own, or even in Panama, they have the same kinds of Indians, and the way they make their money is through craft. And they have little, they simulated villages that they show tourists how they used to live, and they do a little dance for you. And I in Guyana, I bought two belts, and it's you would like to see the imagination of these belts are so well made. You could pay as much as you want to pay for a regular leather belt, and it would not equal the workmanship that you get on one of these belts made by these
what
Indians.
What material is the belt made from?
Well, it's a combination. The backing would be a leather, and the top part would be some kind of Indian pattern. It's made like a tapestry.
Oh, I see.
Right. It's all weaved into the leather. It's really, really fabulous. And I just have to, as soon as I wear the belt anywhere, somebody will ask, where did you get that?
Is it colorful? Does it have different colors on it?
Yes. I mean, in fact, yesterday I had one on with, it blends into browns and maroon colors. Another one, when you wear jeans, it's got that color to blend in jeans, embellished by brighter colors. So, I mean, but each one is an artwork in itself. It's amazing.
Unique. Yes, I see what you mean.
And what it tells you is like people, the maroons and these indigenous Indians, the kind of work that they do, is worth acquiring some of this stuff. Even pottery stuff, that they do. I have a handmade, what you call it now, where you put a planter. Not a large one, but a small one with the typical patterns that Indians would make.
I see. Like you'd get in Mexico and all of
that. My point, though, is that you would find maroons in Jamaica, but the maroons were merge with some of these same Indians that I'm trying to describe to you. And they're all over Latin America and the Caribbean and South America.
Right. You know? Those were the first in those parts of the world. For people.
Exactly.
But I want to tell you a little interesting story that one of my associates, here in the United States, he has passed away. He was a Muslim, and he told me that he went to, I think it was Australia or someplace, and they had like a special convention for maroon someplace, and he went there to this place, whatever they think, and he said this is quite some time ago, he said there were maroons coming from different parts of the world, to this one place. And the weird thing is, Lay, that they all almost spoke the same language. They were doing the same things or practicing the same customs, what part of the world they came from. They were discovering that they were doing the same things and didn't know that each other existed.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? I remember him telling me that story. And ever since then, I have been curious about what is happening in Jamaica. Because when I was growing there, I knew about them, but never knew of them, I would say. Mm-hmm. But nothing, no details about them. Customs were, what they ate, how they lived, how they worshipped, nothing like that. I don't know if any of that information is available anywhere.
Well, don't forget that there were Maroons, in different locations in Jamaica. There were separate groups in Leeward Island.
I didn't know
Island.
That. I thought they were the only ones that were exempt from being part of the Jamaican culture were the ones in the cockpit country.
Well, the eventually they sort of I guess as soon as they thinned out, they congregated. That could be the wrong word because there weren't all that much, many of them left.
You mean recently, but originally they were all in one place.
No, I don't think so. I think there were dispersed.
All the documentation I've been researching said they fled there. That is where all of them fled, because those were the original ones were the ones under the Spanish. The British never ruled them.
That is correct. And when the British tried to get them to help out with the, you know, occasionally they would have slave riots, and the slaves would head for the Maroons.
Mm-hmm.
And the British were trying to get the Maroons to turn them in.
Right.
And, yeah, and they wouldn't do it, and especially in the cockpit area now, that is why they were so protective of their
right.
Their
I think that's the only place in a major set of them were, though. They were not all over the island. They might have come from there and then settled, but all ever since that time I've been researching it, and I would really love to talk to your friend that has perhaps been there and done that. I'm really perked up now. Because I think that it's very interesting, and I think it's a great history lesson even for the current Jamaicans, you know, to know.
Yeah, well, we always, you know, as a child we heard about them, and it was sort of mysterious.
Right, right, right. But I mean, to know, it would be sad if wherever they live together as one, they don't have, it's not retained as a museum or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just can't see how, and nobody knows how many of them are alive or anything like that.
I don't know if they have they. No,
how they kept their records of who's who when people were born and people died. I find all those little bits of information, you know, very intriguing.
Yeah.
Because
well,
I accept, like, what's happening in the Amazon where they're discovering all these tribes and these remote islands that still have some of the original people living on it. There's no documentation per se about the amount of people, you know, what they do, as far as Jamaica is concerned.
Well, that would be just as secretive as the people themselves, I would think.
Right, right, right. Because the government couldn't go in and take a census.
Right. Now,
because they don't belong to them. So I wonder what they call themselves, if they call themselves Jamaicans.
Oh, I don't know. Because, you know, they had their own identity. And they more associated themselves with, the, as I said before, the Araucanians and stuff like that. But look, I read about Nanitown, which was in Portland.
Uh-huh.
And then I read about some of these people in St. Elizabeth as well. So I don't know how to take that. Based on what you were saying about just
so
the
they
doctor.
Were Maroons?
Yeah.
They came from a Kapong town.
It's very hazy how they, you know, how you try to identify where and.
No, the point is they couldn't live in St. Anne's Bay and not be. They would be part of the. They wouldn't be considered Maroons then. The Maroons.
They're Maroons in that they
They left the maroon place, but you know what I mean. They came out of their own country then, because it's a country within a country,
yeah.
And then migrated to the rest of the Jamaican culture. That then they're no longer a maroon, because I think
I wouldn't say that. Their origins are maroons.
Right, but what I mean is
they assimilated into the Jamaican culture, so it diluted the maroons as a people.
Right, but what I mean is, from what I understand, the maroons that fled in the cockpit country, if they did something, the police can't go up there and arrest them. Nobody knows what's going on within their compounds or where they live. They have their own birth information, death information, blah blah blah. That's what I meant. So if they grew up or lived in St. Anne Bay and they had a baby, it would be registered in St. Anne Bay. So it they're not longer protected with that set up that live up in the cockpit country, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, all right.
They lived anywhere else. So that is why these documents are, I suppose, the ones that I've read would not consider them then.
Yeah.
You know, a part of the pack. Because they came out.
Yeah, but maybe so.
But it's just very interesting. The whole thing is interesting. But rest of the Jamaicans that are interested in history, I'm sure, would be very intrigued and interested in what your friend has to say about what he knows.
Yes, well, my friend is also mysterious in his own right. So whether he would, go on national radio and say what... it's possible that I'm just saying this as my own sidebar, that maybe they instructed him not to be too, not to disclose much of what he saw. I'm just saying that because.
Oh, okay. Well, the fact that he took pictures to me, once you take pictures, you show it to other people. You don't keep it in your camera.
this is true. And, as I said, to this day, whatever is left of them, they're still as secretive as they were in the early days. So
we'll just put it out there that if any of the listeners come by later on to listen to our show, this is Margaret and Leigh, and we're discussing about the Maroons. And if you have any new information about what's currently happening in how do you say the name of the town that is the Maroon town, Leigh? A compound town?
No.
Do you know how to pronounce it?
The Maroon town? Cockpit town.
That's what the name of it?
Cockpit country.
Cockpit country. But I don't think they have the whole of the cockpit country, though, because I remember when we were doing the show on the birds, they talked about the parrots being in some of the cockpit country. So I think it's just a special area, and I think it's the name of it is Akompong, or I can't remember. I'm just doing it from memory. But I think that is the area that the treaty gave them that property.
Akompong.
Akompong.
Right.
So that was that's the area that is exclusively theirs. And it is in the cockpit country, from what I gather. Anyway, I just find it all so very interesting. And I don't know about you, but I really gained a lot of little details that other people might not find important, but I find it very intriguing, and it has really put me in a better state of understanding, why we took certain things for granted. I know even as a woman in my day when I was not my child, but, you know, when other people were having children, they wouldn't come out of the house for 9 days. And now we find that it was something that came from Africa, really, and it was practiced from the slaves were there, you know, living. So it just got passed down to different generations, and then I'm sure that even the people who were not necessarily from Africa was all doing the same thing, because the little bit of their language got into the other people's language and their customs got into the other people's culture. And even in the foods, there are some touches that is a little bit perhaps of what the Irish put in and a little piece of what the French put in and the Germans put in. So it's just a one big, beautiful pepper pot.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can describe it, because I don't know if any other island have a soup that they call a pepper pot. There are so many things that I don't know, and I'd love to know.
Yes.
But I know you have traveled, have you ever...
Yes.
Do you know if that's on the menu in other places?
Yes, Trinidad, which I wouldn't classify as an island as much as I would Jamaica. I mean, because it's so large, you know.
Right.
But
they have a pepper pot.
They have a pepper pot, which is quite different from our pepper pot. And let me tell you something. The first time I was offered the pepper pot, I thought it was like Jamaican pepper pot, and this was really a pepper thing.
It's
hot, and it comprises of stewed okra and what is that other green thing there?
Susumba. It wasn't really a soup.
It is a soup.
Oh, it's a soup.
But it's got a lot more butter to it, and
I see.
And it's almost creamy like the way they make it.
Mm-hmm.
But they call it pepper pot.
I see.
Much different. And I suppose maybe other islands have their own pepper pot too.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Especially I went in Panama into an Indian area. They have this big an adjunct to the carnival there, and they have this huge celebration in this Indian territory, and they serve pepper pot, but that was more like ours, you know, a little variation of that.
I got you.
So you find the same foods all over the place, same fruits, everything, everywhere else in the tropics.
Right.
Jamaica is still distinct in a lot of things.
I'm just wondering if the other past colonial places are doing the similar historical documentation that we have been fortunate to have. You know, we have the encyclopedia by that research that person that I use sometimes, Senior, I think is their last name. And then we have Dr. Tortellos, we have Dr. Lumsden, and I'm just wondering if that is going on for the other islands like Barbados and things like that. Do you have any friends from any of those islands?
Yes, I do, but I don't know if they... I'm sure they have scholars from these areas just as we do. So it's likely that they have research, historical traces the way we have. I mean, I have lots of friends... very studious people from Barbados, and they're actually professors. But you know, since we're interested only in Jamaica, so to speak,
right?
I don't really get into their history.
Yes, I was just wondering if there were, you know, similar publications.
I'm
because
sure.
I am encouraging our listeners to really go online and see all the wonderful articles that are there, not just about the people who came, but about all different things. And as you know, I get most of my historic information from those three sources. And they have resources that they use to research to make sure that the information that they have on their information is accurate.
Yeah, well, you know, I know in particular, I don't think I know Lumsden, but I know Rebecca, and the way she got all our information is when she was doing our doctorate.
Right,
she,
so it's our thesis, yes. Uh-huh.
Thesis,
I read that
in
there. But it's a wonderful collection. You know, it's made into a book also that is available on Amazon.
Of course.
Yeah. I think it's just priceless because I've learned so much, really, really so much. You know, the little details that you might know of an event or hear about it, but you don't get really all the details because I think that the little details can make things sort of clearer, a lot clearer, as to why, even in our own culture, you know, why we behave or act or do or, you know, something all the time or sometimes. So that is what is making it so interesting to me.
I'm just thinking from when I went to school, we never got detail of local history, even the way you're doing it here. So, you know, it whatever it got, I would say were just teasers.
Headlines.
Teasers, yeah.
Yeah.
And you wondered what came before and after.
Right.
But,
call it cliff notes.
Yeah. This makes it this fills in the gap, so to speak.
Right, right. Well, I hope, like us, the listeners are enjoying the shows. And if you do, please let us know because it's encouraging to know that it makes sense to you. And if you ever have anything that you'd like us to discuss or talk about, or you want to join the Labrish, please feel free to do so. By sending us an email, we have a website. You go to backyardlabrish.com, and you can communicate with me there. Or right on the page that you're listening, I think there would be some place there that you can send an email or a note. So we thank you for listening. We're almost out of time, and I do hope you've enjoyed your evening with us, that you have been relaxed in your favorite place on the island, and the virtual trip will give you a wonderful weekend, and we will see you next week at the same time. And please remember that all our shows are archived. If you just select a month, you should have a drop-down menu with all the shows. You can always listen to an old show. And if you find something that may interest another friend, do just copy and paste the link and send it to them, and I'm sure it will open up in their browser. If not, you can send them to our website, which is www.backyardlabrish.com, and over to the right, they will find the Backyard Labrish icon, and I mean the Blog Talk radio icon, and they can just click on it, and they'll get directly to the Backyard Labrish shows. So again, we thank you for listening. Leigh, thanks a million as usual. You're always here to support the Labrish. And I appreciate you, and I'm sure that the other listeners do too. So thank you very much. Do you have any parting words?
No, I just I'm glad that I see a little bit of spring coming in the air here. I hope I'm not expecting any more snow this year, but who knows?
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes it comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb. So
well,
we look for the opposite to happen this March, this spring.
There was a beautiful day in these parts, and I hope we're in for some, because it reminds you of, you know, what you describe when you start the program, your blog, about
sitting
and relaxing and experiencing some nice breezes and stuff.
Wonderful.
That's what we had today.
So, ladies and gentlemen, when you want to experience springtime all the time, just take a virtual trip to Jamaica, or better yet, join us here, or just click on one of the shows, and that Calypso classic or reggae classic will put you in the mood that you'll just be transported to your favorite place on the island, and you will just relax and get still, and you'll love it. So once again, good night. Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next week. So
good night.
Mr. Lay from the Bronx, thank you very much, and make it a great week. Bye.
Bye.